I am happy to welcome you all for our second session of NBC in Business. Its time has come. I would like to introduce Miki Kashtan and Sarah Wilson-Jones. Miki Kashtan is a certified trainer with the Center for Nonviolent Communication and is the co-founder of Bay Area Nonviolent Communication. She is based in the San Francisco Bay Area and has been leading workshops and intensive retreats in nonviolent communication for many, many years, offering mediation, meeting facilitation, coaching, training for organizations throughout the states and internationally. She has supported the U.S. Department of Peace campaign with monthly conference calls since 2005. And Miki holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California at Berkeley. And I also want to mention that Miki is the author of Spinning Threads of Radical Aliveness, and her session is Creating Collaborative Organizations. And with her, we have Sarah Wilson-Jones. And Sarah is the owner of Phoenix Coffee Company in Cleveland, Ohio. And her company has been recognized locally and nationally for award-winning coffee and a unique, rich company culture as a result of her 20 years of investing in the growth and the development of her talented staff. Sarah is passionate about the efficiency, beauty, and meaning that is created in high-trust workplaces. I want to thank Miki and Sarah for being here, and I turn it over to you.
Thank you. This is Miki speaking, and I would like to say a bit more about why we're doing this together. Sarah and I met a year ago at a training in Cleveland, Ohio. There was kind of like a lightning spark that happened. I still remember it, like the many moments in which you looked at me and it was very clear to me that what I was saying was being said special for you, even though it wasn't my initial intention before I came to that retreat.
Yes, I felt that way too.
And so we have started collaborating in a variety of ways. And one of the ways that we are collaborating is that I am offering ongoing coaching to Sarah about implementing these principles in her business. So this has become an amazing laboratory to see what one person who is committed to bringing these principles, even though it's not everyone else who is committed. In fact, your number two isn't.
Right.
How to work with that, how to bring it into an organization with the goal of embedding it in the systems and processes and policies and procedures and everything that happens in the company to such a degree that it no longer depends on Sarah. So that's why I wanted Sarah to be here with me. So we are actually going to be in conversation, and in certain moments we will involve you in the conversation, hopefully, as well. Anything you want to say as an opening, Sarah?
I don't think so. That sounds like a good place to start.
Yeah. So I wanted to start with a little story that really seems to illustrate so deeply the point about why we need to embed things in the systems, and the interpersonal relationships and the individuals are not the entire thing. So the story is of another coffee company that I have engaged with at different times. For some reason, I keep ending up working with coffee companies, even though I personally don't drink coffee. My body can't handle it even. But be that as it may, in that company, there seems to be a situation where many of the people are asked to fill out a certain form, do a certain procedure before the end of their shift, and they haven't been doing it. And the way that their managers have been responding to it is very familiar. I'm sure everybody has experienced it. It's like, this is not acceptable, do it. This is not acceptable, do it, escalating it. If you don't do it, there will be consequences. And still the people are not doing it. The person who is in charge of HR within that company realized that that tells her that there is a systemic issue. It's not a deficiency in the individuals, which is what we are used to thinking. We just need to fix the individuals and their behavior would shift automatically. There's something systemic that makes it not happen. And in the process of searching for what that is, what she discovered in collaboration with the people who were not doing it, she ended up sending them an email, what's going on? I need to learn. So asking them what's keeping them from doing this task uncovered several things, one key item of which is that they were not connected to a sense of meaning and purpose about why this is in place, why the particular procedure is in place, and they were also not connected with how the information was going to be used, and they didn't have a sense of being supported in the things that they needed to be able to do that. All of these are systemic things. It's not anything about those individuals. No matter how hard they would be pushed, those problems would still not go away. So this is kind of like to set the stage for why we need to branch out of the very habitual way, especially in the culture of North America, of thinking that everything is about individuals. If only individuals, all of us, and especially the other individuals, started behaving better, then everything would be solved. Stories like this have gotten me to think a lot about, you know, what are then the systems that are necessary for organizations to function? That's one question that I want to look at today. And the second part of the question that I want to look at, it's an independent part, and it's key to the project that is of interest to me, which is how can those systems be set up in a way that brings to life the collaborative principles that many of us care about and that are becoming more and more clearly necessary for the survival of our species. I want to say that the first thing that is needed is, before you even have any other systems, is a clear statement of shared purpose that people can really buy into. It's the foundation of everything else, because when I, as an employee at any level, when I know what my actions are contributing to, I am much more motivated to give my all. And the level of engagement in workplaces in this country and around the world is so low because of the lack of a sense of meaning. Sarah, I'm wondering if you have anything you want to say about what you've been learning so far as in your attempts to support your organization, both within the organization as a whole and within teams, to create a shared purpose. Anything that you can say about that?
I have learned that establishing a shared purpose is kind of like trying to build a boat while you're in the water a little bit, because it's so important to do, and it can be hard to do while you're in the midst of just the work itself. But I am so clear every day how much a shared purpose would really open things up for my organization. And just to share with everyone, I mean, this is something that I've been working on for months now. It hasn't been an easy task for us, but it's something that's going to be very meaningful. And I'm very close to clarifying it. We've gone back and forth with my team and me and trying to figure out how we're going to come to that discernment process. I'm running an organization that's been in business for 20 years, so there's a lot of data and a lot of input to factor into distilling down that shared purpose that really unifies everything and pulls it together. So it's challenging, mm-hmm. but it's very meaningful.
I also want to tell another little story, which is that I did some work in an organization at various levels, at, you know, different teams, because the organization had a vision and mission, and that was enough for the sense of shared purpose for the whole, and then we moved to creating shared purpose at each of the different levels. And I remember the moment when I was working with the admin team. It was a manufacturing company. There was an admin team, and their statement of shared purpose was something like, we are a hub of support providing accurate, timely, responsive services to the whole organization. And as soon as the last T was crossed, and it was completely collaborative, everybody tweaked it. When the last T was crossed and it was clear that this represented the entire team, one person instantly, spontaneously said, now I know why I am important. And this story illustrates for me more than anything else what the value of a well-articulated shared purpose is.
Actually, Mickey, I have a story that will feed into, it goes from shared purpose into feedback systems that I think, because I think that's where you're going next after this, right?
No, I'm going to decision making.
Ah, okay. Well, I'll share it anyway and we can bookmark and come back to the, you'll come
sure.
back to the feedback. We were having a meeting with one of my teams about establishing shared purpose just for that team, not for the whole company. The whole company is the one that's puzzling me more than anything. But that team was able to distill what we are calling a working shared purpose. And what ended up coming out of that meeting, and the shared purpose was about supporting each other so that they could support and connect with the customers. So the feedback system that ended up coming out of that was the one that you and I have spoken about before,
yeah.
where they recorded data every day based on the things that were done during the day that either sharpened or blurred their ability to focus on the customers. So the establishing of the shared purpose helped us to establish a really meaningful and interesting feedback system. So it was kind of cool the way it all worked out.
Thank you. Because as I'm introducing the systems, one of the things that are really clear to me is that the purpose of a shared purpose statement is to guide everything that happens. That is its function. If it's just sitting on some wall gathering either dust or flowers, it doesn't really matter. But if it's sitting on a wall, it's not a living document. It's not a living statement that people can use to say, is this action going to serve the purpose or not? Then it hasn't reached its usefulness. So the four systems that I want to introduce today are decision-making, feedback, conflict resolution, and resource allocation. And the main thing that I want to say is each of these systems needs to be set up in a way that is clear, that is connected to the shared purpose, and that reflects the values of the organization. In particular, with decision making, which is the first system, I have found in my work that as much as people want to participate, they are willing to accept not participating in decision making. It's much harder for them to accept lack of clarity. Most people are willing to accept because they're habituated to thinking, you know, this is a workplace, I'm not the boss, the boss decides, but at least I want to know how all of it is fitting together. I've seen this again and again, and the clarity is really, really simple. It answers three questions and sometimes a fourth one. The three questions are, who makes which decisions with input from whom, telling whom? And the fourth question that sometimes is important is when. There are places where decisions are made and are not shared until much longer, or they take forever to make. So sometimes it is important to add this, but the fundamental part of the decision making is who makes which decisions, with input from whom, telling whom the results of it. My belief is that if these questions are answered, globally and within each department and within each team, any organization will function dramatically better. Now, in terms of what it means to have one of the values that we're trying to align with be collaboration, maximizing both collaboration and efficiency, there are a lot of ways to think about how do we make a decision-making process more collaborative. The one that most people think of when they think of collaboration and the reason why they kind of like give up and say forget about collaboration, it's inefficient, is the thing that says everybody participates in all decisions. Now imagine a company that has thousands of employees. Of course it's not practical to do this. So what is a way to create collaboration intelligently and efficiently so that there is maximal input from the people who are affected by the decision or who have wisdom or input to offer into the decision? That's a question that can be asked continually. And based on Sarah's experience, which I am going to ask her to talk about, it's not an overnight shift.
No.
So you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think I'm going to tell two stories. One is a little, it's not exactly a story. It's just really, I just want to name that my awareness of this principle, which, you know, I've only really been working with this for about a year now, recently inspired me to challenge my financial team to assemble relevant budgetary and cash flow data so that we can make better quality decisions about how we're spending money. Because what was happening is people were coming to me all the time asking me whether or not they could buy this or that or do this project, and it just was driving me crazy because I felt like I was making decisions in the dark and just didn't have a lot. If there wasn't clarity around it, and I was really a bottleneck there. So this principle came to mind, and I'm like, wait, it doesn't have to be like this. This is a decision-making process. I'm making a decision by continuing to do this in this automatic, habitual way, and it just led me to reexamine that and to challenge them to let's set up the system differently so that other people can make this decision, not just me. So that's been a really inspiring and interesting process. It's relatively fresh, so it hasn't played out all the way, but the movement I'm feeling is just so exciting. And then the other one is about we're building a fourth cafe, and the way that we determined this location and where we're going to build this fourth cafe was determined really 100% by my staff. So this is the first time, and I've built probably, I'd say, close to a dozen cafes in my 20 years of doing business, and all of the locations had been chosen by me and my former husband and maybe one or two other people were kind of involved in that final decision-making process. But over the past year, our culture shift has been significant enough that the feedback and the information coming from the staff really led us to look in a totally different direction that I wouldn't have otherwise gravitated towards. And even selecting the actual building that we went into, that was all done by my staff. So when we went to go look at the actual location, like with the realtor, instead of just me and, you know, maybe one other person showing up to look at the location, it was literally my entire team. There was like 10 of us that wanted to go look at it. Mm. And they all felt, they all knew that their voice and what they thought about this location was important and that this was a project that we were undertaking as a company and as a team. It wasn't just, I mean, you know, I was still the one signing the lease, but it was, you know, it's being done as a collaborative effort, not as, you know, I didn't feel as alone in taking that risk. It was a really different process for me.
Yeah, and so there is, what you see here in this is that as you engage differently with people in the decision making, what you increase is goodwill, buy-in, motivation, and very often the wisdom of the decisions themselves.
Yes.
And to go back to the story from before, you know, once the HR person asked the people what they wanted to do about the situation, they had ideas about what to do instead of the particular system that wasn't working. When I work in organizations, so many times I hear from people further down the quote-unquote chain of command a huge frustration about they decide without asking us, and they don't know what we are actually doing. They don't know what the effect will be. So there's something about gathering more wisdom, having more goodwill, and having a longer-lasting, more robust decision that happens through collaboration. And there's a whole question about how do you do it in a way that is efficient. And I have a second session during this summit that is where I'm going to kind of like zoom in on decision-making and on the principles that make collaborative decision-making both collaborative and efficient. And that I'm not going to get into more of that today because that second session exists. I only want to say that this is clearly one of the hardest things for us to create a shift in because our imagination is kind of like truncated by not exercising this, and our collaboration muscles have atrophied. So I am complete with this topic, although there's so much more to say, but for now I'm complete unless there are questions or comments from anyone on the call. I really would love to hear from you.
I had a question about the statement of purpose, the shared purpose, and how to go about creating something like that. I know Sarah's been working on it for weeks and weeks, and I wonder if you have any suggestions for the how.
Yes, you get together a small enough group, and you can do it iteratively. So let's just start with a small group, and then we can think about how you can involve people when there's a large group. And you actually ask each person to say what they think is the purpose of the group, or the team, or the department, or the organization, it doesn't matter. What is their understanding of what it is? And somebody facilitates this process, captures it, and keeps integrating different pieces until, you know, you keep going around like this. Something emerges as a thing that captures a core essence that everybody can go, yes, that's it. You ask people to highlight words that are particularly important to them. You just do, you know, all kinds of facilitation techniques that exist to reach the statement that captures the most in the room. Does that give you something to start with?
It does. I'm curious when you say small group, if there's a number.
I would say 10 people is the maximum. And it may come down to, at some point, you need to pick, you know, two or three people to do the final wordsmithing and bring it back to the group. And if you have a larger group, then you can do it iteratively, either, you know, do smaller groups looking at it, and then each group picks a representative and you do it concentrically. Or another thing that is a kind of an amazing thing is you pick people at random and you see what emerges from that. You probably need to have, you know, if there is a person that created the organization that is the visionary, you can't leave them out. Because often enough, especially if the organization wasn't running in a collaborative way, it's very likely that the vision lives only in that person. If it hasn't been spread around actively.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Okay, so I would like now to proceed with feedback. What I want to say to begin with is that whether an organization is collaborative or not, I would recommend pretty much the same basic structure and framing around feedback. And the fundamental shift is from performance evaluation system that is based on reward and punishment and is ritualized. You know, there's the annual performance review and everybody dreads the day and everybody goes, phew, that's over. The shift from there to feedback as an opportunity for everyone to learn how to work together better. And I have come to believe that everybody wants feedback because feedback is the fundamental learning mechanism. It's built into nature. And one of the things that concern me about our current life on planet Earth is that we have done so much to disconnect feedback loops on so many levels, even something as simple as the pricing mechanism that companies use doesn't take into account the full cost of producing something, only a certain amount of direct costs. And the result is that we don't know, we don't have a way of seeing the destruction of resources that goes into creating a certain thing if everything is measured in the way that it is. Anything from here to feedback turning into criticism and therefore becoming useless for people. Everybody wants feedback, nobody wants criticism. That's kind of like the fundamental entry point into creating feedback systems that work. So the question for me about creating a feedback system is, who needs to give feedback to whom for the learning to happen in all the ways that it does? And essentially, it's the people that I work with. It doesn't matter if I supervise them or they supervise me. If I work with you, we both need to give each other feedback. Feedback then becomes a gift. It's different from telling you how upset I am with you. That's not feedback. That's me wanting to be heard. It takes work to convert disappointment, frustration, or upset into usable feedback. The question is how to systematize it, how to make it something that is part of the ongoing functioning of any relationship and any team and flows throughout the organization continually without being some kind of a burden or an extra task or a dreadful thing. That's the fundamental thing about feedback systems. And although we're not getting into the details, I do want to provide just a tiny bit, just a bare bones of what makes feedback useful. It's a few elements. One is being able to tell people exactly what it is that they did or didn't do instead of evaluating what they did or didn't do. For people who have learned NVC, that is the same difference as the difference between observation and evaluation that we learn in NVC. And it is particularly critical when we try to give feedback, because if I can tell you what you did or didn't do, we establish a shared point of reference in relation to which the learning can happen. So that's one thing that is critical. Second is a way of explaining why it matters, which fundamentally is directly related or one step removed from either the shared purpose or the shared values. So you did or didn't do this, and why it matters somehow is related to what we do, how we do it, why we do it, how we want to engage with each other while doing it. It's not just anything about anything. It's, I am offering you the gift of telling you what you do, why it matters, and the last thing is what I imagine you can do to improve your function in this area. I also want to tell people always all the ways that I like what they're doing with equal specificity to the things that I don't like. There is equal and sometimes more learning that happens from me coming to tell you, you know, yesterday you did this and that was an amazing feat. It allowed us to finish production earlier than usual, and it was just an amazing celebration. And still, I want to, you know, to tell you ways that I see that the same thing can happen more, or I can ask you to share what you learned with other people. There's always something that can be done to improve, regardless of how well it functions so far. And once the feedback is given, I also want to be open to hearing from the person who receives the feedback what went into them doing it the way that they're doing it, so that I remain open to learning that what I thought wasn't working actually worked for a different reason from what I know, or it didn't work for different reasons, and there's something for me to learn either systemically or individually about how to set it up in a way that will function better. And I believe that Sarah has a couple of stories about how she's implemented feedback systems within her company in a way that has yielded benefits for a lot of people.
Absolutely. This is something that's been really alive for us recently. We've been spending a lot of time talking about feedback systems and how to build it into all aspects of the organization. And the thing that's happened most recently is as a result of a conversation that Mickey and I had about a month ago, I changed the format of my weekly managers meetings. I used to go around and meet with my managers for each of the stores individually, and we changed the format so that now we're meeting all together, which was fantastic because I got like 4 hours of my Tuesday back, so that was really exciting. And also, we changed the format of the meeting, and we changed it to asking questions. And the questions that we've been asking, well, at the first meeting, we asked each person to share the most successful thing that had happened at their store that week, what contributed to that success, and what would make that success more likely in the future. So that was super interesting because they each get to learn from each other and what's working at each of the stores. And then the second group of questions was, what grand failure have you experienced this week? What have you learned from it? And that particular question, the grand failure question, I was actually kind of scared to ask that the first time, and I could sense that the managers were a little afraid to share, but I think I had shared with them ahead of time that I was going to ask that question so that they could kind of be thinking about it because I didn't want to blindside them with it. But I was really shocked at the depth of the information that I got, because previous to starting to use this format, I was becoming frustrated with a couple of my managers, and then I felt like they were only ever giving me the good news. They weren't ever giving me, you know, the struggles and the things that weren't going right at the store, which is where the learning really happened. And I just really appreciate this question and this practice because it really normalizes the fact that things don't work out and that failure happens. It's failure is very much a part of success. And so by focusing on the failures and what's not working, it encourages people to be trying things out and experimenting, which is really what I'm interested in, is that learning edge. So that's been a really interesting one. And then just one more detail on that is that the second week we had this meeting, I forgot my notebook with the questions, and I phrased the question differently, and I didn't use the word grand. I said, what has been your biggest failure this week? And I still got good data, but I don't feel like it went as deep as when I use the word grand failure, because there's something about the word grand failure that really invites people into this idea of taking a risk and failing gloriously, as another friend of mine says. And there's something really powerful and courageous about that spirit of really going all in and trying things out, experimentation. So, Yeah, so that's been a really interesting way to build feedback into our weekly schedule.
Thank you.
Celebrating that one, yeah.
So I'd like to pause again and see if people have any questions about this part, about setting up feedback systems for learning.
I love the idea of getting feedback from the staff, and so I'm just wondering, how do you make it seem like not a burden to do that and get them really allow themselves to be, I guess, vulnerable with each other? I mean, we have teams and we have shared purposes, but they expect the feedback back to come from the supervisors and instead of each other. I don't know how to facilitate that.
Gradually, and also to give feedback to the supervisor, not just to each other.
Okay.
And you can start building the willingness by taking a few, I don't know, do they meet every week?
No, every month.
Okay. You can start building the confidence by the first 3 months, only positive feedback. Each person tells one other person in the room, let's say in a round robin, something that they saw this person do that contributed to their ability to work together as a team towards the shared purpose. And you build that over a few months, and then you say, okay, we've built some trust here, and now I want us to go to the second level of learning, which is we also tell each other something that we saw each other do that didn't contribute, and why, and what we want to see done about it. Where does learning need to occur? It's not always in the person who didn't do it. Does this help?
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I'm enjoying this very, very much, and I do have a background in organizational behavior and psychology, and I know that with doing the consulting work that I've done, the idea of the leader's vision and being able to have that shared vision. This is all very, very consistent with everything. And I guess what I wanted to see was how we were going to use, in terms of connecting the NBC principles to this model. I guess I wanted to hear more linkage to what makes it specifically NBC-ish.
It's a number of things. One is that I hold awareness of people's needs as I create these systems. And I hold awareness of needs at the organizational and at the team level. So it's not just random. Needs are part of it. And in particular, you know, around decision making, actually around all of these things, one of the key needs that people have in the workplace, not only in the workplace, except it tends to not be met in the workplace, is the need to matter. And I hold that in my awareness when I work with teams, with leaders, especially when there's power difference. The person at the bottom is almost by definition going to not trust that they matter. So that's one place where the specific NBC lens for me comes in. A second place is around how I think about power and how I relate power to needs. That's a bigger topic than I could possibly cover here. And I'm really appreciating the question. It's kind of like power has to do with whose needs are being included when I make decisions. So I'm wondering if that gave you even a little bit of a taste about that.
Thank you, and I'm interested to hear the rest of what you have to say. Thank you.
Sarah, you wanted to add something here.
Yeah, just something quick that came up in answer to Sharon's question. Something that occurs to me is that, especially around the feedback system, I think that NVC is about, you know, on Marshall's book, the subtitle was A Language of Life. And a big part of NVC is concentrating on what's alive. And feedback systems, that's really the movement that they enable, is to really focus on what's alive in people and to serve what's alive.
in the moment. So I think that the more we bring those feedback systems, you know, that's such a part of nature and it's just such a part of life. So it's bringing life into organizations and VC into organizations. And that's how I see that they relate, at least those two particular things.
Thank you. I am appreciating that. Okay. Let's proceed to the conflict resolution system. So literally earlier today, I got this really succinct, slightly oversimplified clarity about what the purpose of a conflict resolution system is. And that purpose is to turn conflicts into usable feedback for learning. As a situation of conflict is one in which nobody can learn because there is separation between people. There's often judgment. There's upset feelings. There's a lot of things that cloud the capacity of an organism to absorb information in a way that supports learning. And so the kind of like the end goal of a conflict resolution system is to shift and transform the conflict into a form that can be useful. And in the setting up of the system, there's a lot of things that need to happen before you can get there. And one of the first of them is, you know, you mentioned, Sarah, earlier the idea of normalizing failure. And there's a similar thing that is about normalizing conflict. There is a way that so many people have the belief that if you just get the right people and set up the right conditions and the right, I don't know what else, then there will never be conflict. Let's just check, just for fun, if you recognize somewhere in you that belief, that conflict is actually a bad thing that is the result of something not set up right. Let's ask you if you used to have that belief and you've overcome it. You used to believe that conflict is essentially a measure of some kind of failure. Yeah, now the hands are going up. So that's one problem with conflict, is that people have this idea that it shouldn't be there. The second problem with conflict is that people avoid it because they are afraid of making things worse by trying to engage with the conflict. And that is because when the system as a whole doesn't recognize conflict as an ongoing normal part of life, then nothing is set up for it. We don't learn tools. We don't have support for working with conflict. And then if we try to engage with the conflict, at least half the time, we will make it worse. And we will reinforce for ourselves and for everybody else the belief that it's best to avoid conflict. And then they also erupt when we try to avoid them and we try to stifle them. So in setting up a conflict resolution system, what we're trying to do is we're trying to create structures that make it appealing and welcoming and no big deal to go somewhere and say, I have a conflict, I need support. Where there are people and systems and structures and procedures in place for attending to conflict for the purpose of learning from it, restoring what was lost, and gleaning the lessons to make our collaboration more effective later. I want to turn to you, Sarah, to see what you've learned so far in your attempts to create a conflict resolution system.
I love this question. I'm just so thankful for all of the support and learning that I have around this question from you, Mickey, and just from this whole support network of NVC friends and associates and things, because what I've learned in doing this in my organization and my NVC partner and our trust genie, Lisa Hong is her name, she and I have learned that every time we turn towards conflict in our organization, we uncover things that people really care about. And that is the gold. Like, that's what's so interesting about working together, living together, being human beings. And even more so, the deeper we turn towards it, we also almost always uncover a systemic either issue or problem or just piece of information, something that we need to understand about how our system works that is often contributing to that conflict. And it's just without fail. I have such trust in this principle now and in this movement of turning towards the conflict. I'll just do one quick story about one of my espresso repair technicians and our bookkeeper. You know, they had a pretty intense flare-up one day in the office that affected other people who were also present for the conversation. So we sat everyone down to basically have a redo of the conversation and in the interest of restoring trust, because there was some trust lost as a result of how the conversation went. And in the process of redoing the conversation, we uncovered a pretty basic systemic issue. It had to do with literally a column in a spreadsheet that was missing. When the technician went to go place his orders, there was a price column missing for his parts calculations. And it was just creating ongoing problems between the two of them. So we uncovered that, but we also uncovered both of their really commitment to excellence and their interest in doing their jobs well. And it just led to a really beautiful and connecting solution. And every time we turn towards conflict, something juicy happens.
Thank you. And one more thing that I want to add from a conversation that we had earlier is that you've discovered that so far there have been only one or two people who were, quote unquote, the system. You didn't actually create a system. You just had two people doing it.
Right.
That created a bottleneck. Right now, you're in a phase of wanting to expand it to include other people who
Yes.
are charged with supporting the transformation of conflict within the organization. Ultimately, for a conflict resolution system to work well, it needs to be embedded all around, so that that's part of normalizing it, so that it's not like, oh, I have to go to the CEO if I have a conflict, but if like, oh, on our floor, these are the two people who are the go-to for conflict. It's like, just like these are the two people who are the go-to for fixing the electricity. Same kind of simplicity is what we are aiming for.
One other thing I just want to name real quick, Mickey, is, and I'm realizing as we're talking about these systems, how interconnected they are. And working on one system really tends to lead to progress in another system and vice versa. It's just interesting
yeah.
to notice that.
Yep. Thank you. Any questions about conflict resolution system within an organization? I am curious then to hear just how many people are excited about this idea of making this a normal part of a workplace culture, to have a place where conflicts are handled.
I just had a comment. When you said excited, I was thinking, well, some excited and some scared.
Thank you. I am so appreciating this. Of course you would be scared. Because
right.
it's not something that is very common. Don't have blueprints. It's not yet familiar to know. There's no models. You would have to be discovering it on your own, of course. Thank you for that. I appreciate this comment. Thank you. The last piece to talk about for today is a resource allocation system. And essentially, resource allocation is a subset of decision making. However, because of the centrality of resources to making everything else possible, I kind of pulled it out from the overall decision making to highlight how essential it is to have clarity and understanding in the way that resources are allocated within an organization. That's not commonly what happens. And one of the things about that is that people who do the work don't have a big enough picture to understand the resources that go into it and the resources that it generates and what happens to those resources as they come and go. it becomes abstract. There is the they that decides how much money I'm going to make as an employee, and I don't have any real picture about where that money comes from, where it goes, what the expenses are, what the income is, and how the decisions are made about where it goes. So to me, the creating an actual system where people understand what is going on is a fairly radical concept, even before you enter the idea of collaboration. Even increasing transparency around resource allocation is something that many organizations and people in leadership within organizations feel a bit leery about. And yet, again, from my understanding, the more people have a bigger picture, the more responsibly they can operate. And I actually have a story that is not from the workplace. It's just so remarkable that I want to tell it. And then Sarah has a story. One family that experimented with having a bank account for their 7-year-old daughter. They kind of like took the money that they were spending on her, other than the basic expenses like food and things like this, put it in a bank account, and she was in charge of making the decisions about that money. And they commented in the article that I read about it was years ago and I don't have the reference, they commented that they were amazed and surprised by the wisdom of her decisions and by how much more aligned she ended up being with things like health and long-term investments and things of that nature when she understood the consequences and when she was in charge of the whole thing. This story, especially because we tend to think of 7-year-olds as incapable of making strategic, wise decisions about money, tells me that the more people know, the more they're able to act together. And Sarah, you can take this story about the new coffee store and finish it up from the perspective of how that affects people's actions relative to the resources.
Absolutely. I do seminars with new employees about our financial reports and how to read a profit and loss statement. And so there's very much an awareness and a conversation, and then monthly I report the results back to all of the staff and the managers. So there's an ongoing conversation about the profit the company is making and where it's going. And when we decided to do this cafe earlier this year, we decided as a team that all of the profits and positive cash flow that we're able to generate as a company are going to go into this cafe this year. And that's going to be our investment of these resources. And so it's really nice to have that transparency and clarity. So then when people come to me, like the Coventry store really needs a patio and we wanted to buy a new espresso machine and things like that, it's like, well, guys, we've already decided that this is going into the Ohio City Cafe. And it makes the conversation very different than it's ever been before in terms of it's like a group. It's not exactly a group decision, but there's clarity, like Nikki said.
Yes.
There's clarity about what's mm-hmm. happening. It's refreshing. It just takes a huge weight off me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We're almost done. And I personally feel really excited and pleased about how much we were able to cover during this time. And I just would like to hear from a few people what you're taking with you from here, or if you have any final questions.
One thing that I'm taking away from this is the whole idea about normalizing conflict. And the other thing that your counterpart said about how when conflict is happening, it's when you can tell that people care and that there's always something that was good that was coming out of it, and the idea of turning towards conflict.
Thank you.
I really loved. Thank you.
Something you gave me an idea with the feedback system, the idea that, hey, it needs to be easy, it needs to be efficient, et cetera, that got me thinking how I'm a programmer, so I thought, wow, I can make an app for phones. Everybody's got their phone out, and you know they're looking at it all the time, and I thought that would be the most easy, awesome way.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity. And thank you, Sarah. It's so fun to collaborate with you in all the different ways that we do.
Agreed, Mickey. It's so mutual. Always such a rich conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.